You're tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins. This is Science to Sage Radio, and I'm your host. And today we have a really special guest, and his name is Ted on This is a Challenge. Knuts. Why am I laughing? Ted and I have a history together. But Ted, before you tell us how you really say that name, I'm going to tell them a little bit about you. So Ted is a psychotherapist in private practice in Vancouver, Canada. Yet the wisdom he shares in this book doesn't come from formal training. It comes from his own personal journey as a father of a disabled child. This deeply personal journey is an inspiration for all of us who want to move past pain, hurt, and return to peace and joy. Now, okay, Ted, how do I say your last name?
It's Kunz, but I'll take any way you got. So, did we tell them the story about how you introduced me once? So Karen invited me to speak for her school at one point, and she put posters out with my picture and an announcement and my last name, but she had changed the order of the lettering of my last name. And so instead of it being K-U-N-T-Z, she put K-N-U-T-Z. And then I could see when you got to the front of the room and you're trying to figure out how to pronounce this word and you weren't quite sure. And then I think you decided that the K was silent, so you introduced me as Ted Knuts. It's one of my favorite introductions. Karen, did I lose you? I've lost you already. Hello?
Oh, how can you not be there? You're there.
I'm here now.
Okay, great. So there we go. I told you I've had some technical difficulties today, so hopefully that's about as big as it gets. So you know what? Ted has written a book called Peace Begins With Me. And the reason I had a girlfriend who told me about Ted and the extraordinary work he had done because he had a child who had vaccine. And as a consequence, and being a therapist, he had to learn how to come to terms with, I was going to say, Ted, it is like being integrous with yourself because this was very painful for you.
Mm. Yeah.
You
say it was the toughest journey of my life. My son was born healthy and became disabled by a vaccine shot at 5 months of age and developed an uncontrolled seizure disorder. And with the amount of seizing that he experienced, eventually it caused a significant amount of brain damage. And so my son requires 24-hour care and functions about at the level of a two-year-old. And to watch my son lose his capacity and to witness the seizing over and over again was very painful for me and hard for me to make peace with.
Yeah, and you wrote a book, Peace Begins With Me. So why don't you tell us what your outcome, you had a dream and a purpose when you wrote the book and something that you wanted to share. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, what I realized was all of us desire peace. We want to live peaceful, joyful lives. And I've come to the realization that even though we desire that, we actually don't know how to live that way. And you know, my assessment of our society is that we actually teach people how to be angry or to be afraid or to be resentful more easily than we teach them how to be peaceful and joyful and happy. And so in my counseling practice regularly, I see people come in and they just don't know how to be peaceful. They don't know how to be happy. And they're constantly at war with life the way it is, and they're miserable. And I know that misery because I sat in it until it just became overwhelming, and I made a decision one day that I needed to make peace with this condition that was in my son's life and in my life. And I began a journey of trying to figure out how to become peaceful and joyful. And as a result of that, gathered some really valuable information and started to share it. And then people asked me if I had written about it, and I said no. And I got lots of requests to write about it. And so I sat down one day, and it was almost as if it was being downloaded, Karen. I wrote as fast as I could, and the first version came out literally within a few hours. And, of course, it took many more rewrites after that, but And what I say is none of the information is mine. I didn't create anything. I think if I've done anything, what people have said is that I've taken ancient wisdom and I've brought it to a level where we know how to apply it on in our day-to-day lives. And so in some ways what I've done is simplified it.
Well, you know what? There's you think about the ancient wisdom. I love there's a concept in the book that you're following, which is I love the tale of the two wolves and the battle for the heart. So why don't you tell that? Because, you know, to me that was the part that was like, yeah, you describe it because I think it's beautiful.
Well, it's a native story, and one of the things I really admire about the Aboriginal community is that they share their wisdom through storytelling. And most of the Aboriginal groups around the world did not have a written language. Their tradition was always oral, and so their wisdom was communicated through storytelling. And they are able to capture profound wisdom very simply. And this was one of my favorite stories, and I heard it after I began my quest to become peaceful and joyful, and it just resonated with me as profound truth. And it's a story about a grandfather who's walking with his grandson, and they're walking down a path in silence, and after a period of time, the grandfather says to his grandson, "Grandson, there are two wolves that are fighting in my heart, and one wolf is angry and vindictive and wants to hurt others. And the other wolf is kind and loving and compassionate." And the grandson, after hearing the words of his grandfather, is filled with fear, and he says to his grandfather, "Grandfather, which wolf will win the battle of your heart?" And this wise elder responds, he says, "My heart will be won by the wolf that wins the battle of every man's heart. It's the wolf that I feed." And what I came to understand from that very simple story is that every moment of every day we're either feeding a positive wolf or a negative wolf. And so I began my book with that story, and then I shared what I learned about what fed my negative wolf and what fed my positive wolf. And it just became the perfect container for teaching that that information.
You know, it's interesting, Ted, because I know you. And I remember the one time when you were talking, you talked about when you and what really propelled you. You drove up in the driveway, and you always looked to see whether Joshy was there or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that was so painful for you. So why don't you kind of explain that? Because I think that's very, one, insightful and very moving.
Well, that was really, I think that was the day in my life that my life changed. And Josh and I had shared this very simple father-son ritual from the time he was a toddler. And the house that we were living in at the time had a driveway alongside of the house and a carport at the back of the property. And so when I came home from work at the end of the day, I would drive up the driveway and I would park my car. And as the car went along the house, Josh would recognize the sound of my car and he would know that Dad was home. And so he would run to the window that looked out onto the carport and he would wait for me to get out of the car. And when he saw me, he would yell, "Hi, Dad." And I would yell, "Hi, Josh." And I would come into the house. But as Josh got sicker and sicker and the seizures became more and more frequent, at one time he was seizing 12 to 15 times a day, with each seizure 15 to 20 minutes long. And so when I drove up that driveway, I would always be in this angst. Would Josh be at the window today, or was he having too many seizures? Would the window be empty? And I would always feel this angst as I drove up the driveway. And as he got sicker, many times the window was empty, and I always hated that empty window because I knew what it meant. It meant he was having far too many seizures that day to get up and greet his dad as he wanted to do. On this particular day, I drove up the driveway, I parked my car, and I looked to the window as I always did, and there he was in the window, and I can still see his face, Karen. He just had this joy radiating from him, and his grin was from ear to ear, and his nose was flat against the glass, and he yelled, "Hi, Dad." And I said, "Hi, Josh." But I did something different that day. I just stopped and I looked at him and I just wanted to soak in every last piece of joy that was emanating from him and feel the gratitude that he was well enough that day to be there. And something happened to me that day, and I don't know how to explain it. I can just describe what happened. But as I was standing there looking at my son, I heard a voice. And the voice was as loud as if it was spoken. And what I heard was actually a question. And the question was, "When your son looks through the glass at you, what does he see?" And so I thought about that. What does he see when he looks at me? And beyond the joy that was in that moment, what I knew the truth was, he sees a father who's angry, because I was very angry about what happened to my son. And he sees a father who's afraid, because the doctors had warned us that any one of those seizures each day could kill him. And I was in resentment about what had happened. I was in despair because I felt absolutely powerless. And so what he saw was an angry, fearful, resentful, despairing father. But the other answer that came to me is that he sees a father who's rejecting his own son, because the truth was, I didn't want this disabled child. I wanted the son that was still alive in my imagination, the son that was healthy. That was the son that I was desperately holding on to. And so when I came to that, you know, moment of realization about who I was and my way of being in relationship with my son, I just knew that Josh deserved better than that from me. And I remember making a commitment that day to Josh, and I said, Josh, I'm going to learn how to make peace with this. I'm going to learn to find my joy and my happiness again. And I'm going to learn to fall in love with the son that I have, not the son that I don't have. And I began a very intentional journey that day of learning how to make peace with this life circumstance that was now in front of me. And it transformed my life. I am a very different person today than I was that day. And I am in such gratitude to have the son that I have, because he's become the most incredible teacher to me of, I think, the most important things that life has to offer. And I get to be his dad.
You talk about in the book that there was a moment of desperation where you consulted with a psychic.
Yeah.
There
was a, in that desperation when Josh was seizing as frequently as he was, and I felt absolutely powerless to improve his condition. The doctors at our local children's hospital had tried everything, and as a matter of fact, they asked us not to come back. They said there was nothing else they could do to improve his condition. And so I was witnessing my son seize 12 and 15 times a day, each seizure 15 to 20 minutes long. And as I would watch him seize, I would just feel so so sad and so powerless. And I couldn't, the pain was too great. And in my desperation, I did something I had never done before. I went to see a psychic. And the psychic said I could come with questions, and I really only had one question that I really wanted to know the answer to, and that was, will my son live? And so I remember sitting across from this elderly woman, and she said, do you have any questions? And I said, I have one. And she said, what is it? And I said, will my son live? And that's all I said. And there was this pause before she responded, and I remember it felt like forever in that pause, but it probably was seconds. And then she said, have no fear. The son will outlive the father as he should. And when I heard those words, this joy went racing through my heart at the possibilities that Josh would survive this. And a second question came to mind, and that was, well, if he's going to live, what will he be when he grows up?
Mm.
And in this beautiful voice, she responded, she said, your son will be what he already is, and that is a teacher. And I have to tell you, at that moment when I first heard those words, they didn't make any sense to me. I was very confused by her answer, because Josh's capacity had been reduced to the level of a two-year-old. He spent most of his day in seizure or post-seizure. His vocabulary was down to about 40 words. And so my understanding of a teacher as a traditional teacher, I couldn't put those together with my son's medical condition. But as I came to understand and deepen my gratitude for who this young person is and what he brought to my life and what I learned as a result of my journey with him, I know that he's my greatest teacher, and I'm very grateful to be in this journey with him.
You know what, when he was in school, there was an instructor who chose him first as his student. Why don't you explain that? Because that's such a beautiful insight and segue to what you're talking about.
Well, this was the year that Josh went to grade 7, and so he was about 12 years old at the time, and it just so happened the school that he was attending had two grade 7 classes, and both of the teachers were men, and both were crazy about their sports. And they did something that they weren't supposed to do as a way of dividing the students between them at the start of the school year. They flipped a coin, and the teacher that won the coin toss got first pick, And then they alternated picks back and forth until all the students were selected. And so a teacher by the name of Jeff won the coin toss, and he looked at this list of about 70 names, and after about 30 seconds of reflection, he chose Josh with his first pick. And the other teacher, whose name was Mike, was quite confused by that selection, and he said, "Jeff, like, I don't get it. I haven't been around the school as long as you. I don't know all the kids on the list. But I know Josh. I mean, Josh is pretty hard to miss. You know, he's got an uncontrolled seizure disorder. He uses a wheelchair. All of his curriculum needs to be modified. He needs help with toileting. He needs help with eating. He could seize at any moment." And he said, "You know, like, there's kids on that list that are intelligent, creative, great athletes. So why would you choose this disabled boy with your first pick?" And Jeff was one of those amazing people who saw Josh different. And he said, "Let me tell you what I noticed." He said, "I've watched Josh around the school the last number of years, and I see when mom and dad bring him to school in the morning in his wheelchair that the kids run down the hallway and they take turns pushing Josh to the classroom. And I've watched how carefully and gently they take off his coat and hang it up for him and put his lunch kit under the chair. And I've seen during gym or recess, well, they'll change the rules of the game so that Josh can participate at his level of ability. And I've also seen when Josh has had a seizure and he's on the floor and he's in recovery, and the children will get down on their hands and knees and they'll hold his hand and they'll stroke his forehead and they'll whisper in his ear and they'll tell him he'll be okay." And he said, "I see that they're kinder and they're gentler when they're around Josh. And I think if I have him in my class, it will make it a kinder and gentler place for all kids." And it was such a beautiful story. Jeff told me that when I met him quite accidentally in about November of that year, and it took my breath away, and it did for two reasons. One is because it's just a beautiful story of honoring, but the other one was I realized in that moment is that I was more like the other teacher, because all I could see when I looked at my son is the things he couldn't do, and here was this man telling me what my son could do, and it enabled me to look at my son with a different set of eyes that changed the way I experienced this young person in my life.
Mm. I just think that's amazing. Okay, so now here's we're going to make this part. When you were going through this part of learning how to, you either fed the positive woof or the negative woof. You had six ways that you describe in the book that I fed the negative woof. So why don't we go through the list, and because I think in them there are insights that we all can learn on how we all either make our day, you know, positive or negative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I did is, first of all, I just simply made a commitment that I wanted to live peacefully and joyfully. That became my priority. That became my goal. And literally every evening I would review my day and I would say, "Ted, where did you hold on to your joy today and where did you give it away? And how did you give it away? And what might you do different tomorrow?" And by simply observing and paying attention and reflecting upon the way I was living life, I began to notice some things. And so what I actually noticed first was how I was feeding the negative wolf. And so the most obvious action that came to me is I realized that I was constantly imagining the worst. And so when I was in a situation where the outcome was unknown or uncertain, I would imagine all of the worst possible outcomes. And what I've discovered is most of us do that. And I think that we've got this idea that if we imagine all the worst possibilities, that we'll be better prepared if they show up. But the consequence of that imagining is that we cause ourselves significant amount of distress. What I've learned is that our physical body doesn't distinguish between a real event and an imagined event. And so when we imagine negative outcomes, our body responds as if that's true. It doesn't matter that it's only in our imagination. You know, Einstein said imagination is more important than knowledge. And what I realize is most of us haven't figured out or we haven't been taught how to use our imaginations in a constructive way. We tend to use them in a negative way, by all of this a negative imagining. And research actually suggests to us that the average North American thinks 9 times as many negative thoughts as positive thoughts. So most of us are walking around with this negative story in our heads that we tell ourselves over and over and over again. And it makes us sick. You know, what I've realized is most of us suffer more from our imagination than from reality. We scare ourselves with our thoughts than with what actually happens to us. And so, to me, it was one of the first things I needed to do was I needed to get my mental body in order. I needed to take charge of the stories that I tell myself or the stories that I allow to be told to me. You know, there's a native saying that I like. It says, he who tells the stories rules the world. And so, who tells our stories?
That's true.
Yeah. You know, I remember, Karen, there was an article in a parent magazine that I read many years ago, and the title of the article was, Who Tells the Stories That Our Children Hear? And in the beginning of the article, the author, his name is Michael Warren, described how in previous times, and especially in Aboriginal communities, but in ours as well, that a parent or a grandparent would sit down with a little one and tell them a story. And embedded within the story would be the idea, the thought, the perspective, the skill that they wanted the child to acquire. And then Michael goes on to ask the question, who tells the stories that our children hear today? And so who do you think is the primary storyteller of children today? Well, it's TV for the most part, TV and video games.
Yep.
And what he suggests is we've given away the responsibility of storytelling to people we don't know, and in many cases, people that don't even share our values. And so what he implores parents to do in this article is to take back the responsibility of storytelling. And I actually think that's good wisdom for all of us, that we all need to take back the responsibility of the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we allow to be told to us. Because those stories are powerful. And most of the stories that we're exposed to are negative. You know, I used to teach a wellness class at a local community college, and one of the assignments I gave students each semester is I would say, bring a newspaper and a pair of scissors to class. It didn't matter what newspaper they brought, just bring one. And then the assignment was to read the entire newspaper and clip up the stories that are positive and put them in one pile, and the stories that are negative and put them in a second pile. And every year, every class, every newspaper, the results were the same. Is the pile that had negative stories was by far the largest pile, and the pile with positive stories was very few. And yet most of us, as a matter of normal daily practice, we will open up those newspapers or we'll turn on the news and literally inundate ourselves with negative stories. And it affects us.
No, I hear you. You talk, you know, and you talked about that and how we play games in the schools and the games and the things that we teach that are competitive and not necessarily cooperative.
Cooperative or collaborative or creative. Well, the example I use and I described in the preface of my book is I began to recognize how pervasive the game of musical chairs is. And so I started to, in all of my speaking engagements, I would say, just as a matter of interest, how many in the audience here played musical chairs as a kid? And Karen, it's virtually 100% everywhere I go. And if there is a person that doesn't play musical chairs, invariably they're from an Aboriginal community. And I find that fascinating. I could probably name 10 other games that, and I wouldn't get that same level of compliance or participation, but for some reason or other, we play musical chairs almost religiously as a society. And, you know, what's the game about? The game is that there isn't enough to go around, and so we have to compete with each other to get the diminishing resource, and the winner is the one who's the strongest and fastest, and one person wins and everybody else loses. And we play that religiously with our small people. And I wonder what impact that paradigm has on a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old when they play it. And what I speculate is I wonder how our children would be different if we played the game different. And one of the things that I say is you could take away a chair as an opportunity to challenge ourselves, but the goal is that all of the kids need to sit on the remaining number of chairs. And so I believe that if you played the game that way, kids would have to learn that everyone belongs, everyone's included. We have to become creative and collaborative and figure out innovative ways that we all can share in this resource. And I just think the games that we play actually set up the structures by the way we actually look at this world, the lens that we look at the world at. And I think that we're set up for competing with one another as opposed to collaborating and seeing each other as resources.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It reminds me of when I had my son, we'd always go out to the, you know, the playground and play. And I always took more toys than we needed. And that was so other people would come play. And so he always understood there was enough. But that's my story. So back to you. What is, you have, okay, imagining the worst is one. What was the second one that's on your list?
The second one was the idea that I've made a mistake. And in our culture, we just accept that we make mistakes. And what I've witnessed, particularly in my role as a therapist, is that most of us carry around shame about mistakes that we've made in the past and often have fear that gets in the way of making mistakes. And so we become paralyzed about trying things out because we don't want to make a mistake. And I had the opportunity to do some work with a man by the name of Ray Willem, which I really liked, and he had some innovative ideas. I remember he had two books that I liked. One was on choosing with a quiet mind, and the other one was called Have a Plain Day. And what he invited us to consider is that the idea of mistakes is just that. It's an idea. It's a mental construct. And he challenged us to think about, he actually asked us what the biggest mistake was that we made in our life, and he invited us to share that with the entire group. And then he would work with us, and what we came to understand is that what we were calling a mistake was actually the best decision available to us in that moment with the information, knowledge, and skill that we had. And so Josh's mom, for example, carried around the judgment that she made a mistake in getting Josh vaccinated that day. And yet, at that moment, that's what we thought was the right thing to do. That's what we thought responsible parents did. And so we often stick this label on us when we get an outcome we don't anticipate. And that causes us to live in fear or shame or guilt. And the other thing that he shared with us is he told us about working with a group of First Nations people, and he would do the same exercise, invite them to share what their biggest mistake was. And then he said, I did something different with that group is I invited them to take a break, and during the break, find an elder in their community who speaks their native language. Find the word for mistake in their native language and bring it back to the group. And when they all returned, what was revealed is that most Aboriginal groups around the world do not have a word for mistake in their native language. That's a Western concept. And he said the closest to the Western idea of mistake was the Sioux tribe, and they have a word that roughly means sometimes when I pull the arrow back in my bow, the arrow doesn't go where I intend. And what I loved about it was simply an acknowledgement that we don't always get the outcomes that we anticipate. But what was missing was the shame, the blame, the guilt, all of the judgment that seems to be packaged up with our word mistake or our mental construct called mistake. And so I see lots of people that feeds their negative wolf.
Yep. Yep. We've all done that one. And number three.
Well, I talk about thinking like a victim. And
that's it.
The way this often shows up is statements like, and I hear them all the time, I don't want to, but I have to. I have no choice. You know, I don't want to go to work, but I have to. I don't want to pay my taxes, but I have to. I don't want to diet, but I have to. I don't want to take out the garbage, but I have to. And so I hear lots of people who act like they're victims. They act like they're powerless. And to me, it's not true. Those statements are not true. You know, when people tell me, well, I don't want to go to work, but I have to, I say, I give you permission not to go to work. And they say, oh, great. And then they say, well, I get a paycheck. And I say, no. Well, you know, but I want a paycheck, right? Well, and if you want a paycheck, the way that we get that at this point in our society is through work. And so would you like to go to work and receive a paycheck or would you not? Like, to me, you either step into that or you don't. But to say that you want to but you don't want it but you have to is, to me, we're lying to ourselves and we're setting ourselves up for frustration, for anger, for resentment by those statements. And, you know, I think that, again, we get taught this. You know, when you turn on the news, for example, it's not uncommon to hear a politician will say, you know, we had no choice but to raise taxes. Or you'll hear the CEO of a company say, we had no choice but to lay off 400 people. And I believe the politician and the chief executive officer are not telling us the truth. If they were telling the truth, they would say something like this. They would say, I reviewed all of the options before me, and based upon what I value and the outcomes I'm looking for, I've made a decision to raise taxes, or I've made a decision to lay off 400 people. To me, that's standing in your power, and that's taking responsibility for your choice. But what's regularly modeled for us is people who act as if they're not responsible, who act as if they have no choice, who act as if they have no power. And so it's not surprising that most of us then come to believe that we have no power, which is not true. We're very powerful beings, and we have to own our choices.
I like the quote you have on the book by Edgar Tolle, "A victim is someone who believes their past is more powerful than their present." That's a good one.
Well, yeah, because most of us, I do work with the local victims assistance program that is through the local police station, and one of the things I say to them every year is, like, I'd really like you to change the label, because you put people into a container, you call them victims, and then in order for them to be healthy, they have to let go of that label. So don't put them in that container in the first place. But
mm-hmm.
It seems to be the construction that we have in this society. And, you know, I think we do ourselves a disservice when we call ourselves victims. Have we had challenging life experiences? Absolutely. You know, my journey with my son was very challenging to me because I was unprepared and didn't have the wisdom or the skills to deal with it well at the time. But I resent being called a victim. That's not true.
Well, that goes back to number four, living the past or the future.
Well, and this is received this wisdom from Eckhart Tolle, and I had the good fortune of working with Eckhart in the very early stages of his teaching. Eckhart is the author of The Power of Now and has done some beautiful work about living in the present. And in my very first gathering with Eckhart, there was probably about 15 or 20 of us in the room, and he said to us, "Where do you live?" And then he said, "I'm not interested in which community you live in. I'm interested, do you live in the past, the present, or the future?" And nobody had ever asked me that question before, and so I was quite surprised by it. And when I thought about it, I realized that I was almost never here. I was either in memory, recalling something that had already happened, or I was living in anticipation of what might happen. Even if it was only seconds away, it was still in anticipation, as opposed to being immediately exactly where I am, that my mind and my body are in the same place at the same time. And what I've come to respect is that there's value in being in memory and using the memory we have about what's occurred, and there's value in living in anticipation, but do we spend any time present? And I've made a decision that my life works the best when I spend about 80% of my day in this present moment, exactly here, right now, exactly where I am. Because to me, that's where life exists. The other stuff is just in our mind. It's in our imagination. It's mental. And I don't want to live my life in my mental body so much. I used to live there all the time. And to me, that's not where joy exists. That's not where peace exists. That's not where life exists.
But, you know, you have an analogy in your book, and I really like the analogy about how the house is wired with an alarm system. I think that's perfect. Why don't you explain? Because I think that puts it right into the – I think it puts it right on target.
Well, you know, what I noticed was is that when I'm in the future, when I'm living in the future, in my mind, particularly with a negative story, I have this unease in my body. It's like it's the angst. It's the anxiety that we feel. And I discovered that when I would bring my mental body right into my physical body, when I brought myself back together, my mind would get quiet and my body would get quiet. And so I started thinking that, you know, the creator of this human body actually was pretty smart, that it built an alarm system into us. And it's not unlike the alarm system we have in our house at our windows or our doors. And when the contact becomes disconnected, the alarm goes off. And when you close the contact, the alarm goes off. And I think that when my head and my body become disconnected, this alarm goes off to say, "Ted, you're disconnected. Put yourself back together." Because I've noticed when I bring my head and my body in the same place at the same time, the alarm goes out. And so I believe that there's wisdom in that body of ours that is reminding us that we're disconnected. Bring yourself back together.
Yep. The next one is resisting reality.
Well, that's when I would say things like, it shouldn't be this way, you know, that car accident shouldn't have happened. The plane crash shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't be this cold at this time of year. My favorite sports team really should have won that game the other night. You know, those are all statements that are insane because, you know, what Eckhart Tolle says, one of the most insane things we do is to resist something that already exists.
Mm-hmm.
Because the act of resisting it, saying it shouldn't have happened, doesn't change the event. The event already exists. What it changes is us. into somebody who's frustrated or discouraged or in tension or in resistance or in resentment. And I realized I spent most of my life in resistance. You know, I would say over and over again, my son should never have been damaged by that vaccine shot. Well, that's insanity. He was, it is, and resisting that doesn't change it. And so I had to learn how to accept reality as opposed to spend so much time in resistance.
Next one is delayed happiness.
Yeah. Well, and this is just that simple statement, I'll be happy when. And again, I would regularly hear this in my work with my clients. I'll be happy when the weekend comes. I'll be happy when I have holidays. I'll be happy when I get married. I'll be happy when I get divorced. You know, I'll be happy when I have children. I'll be happy when the children leave home. You know, it's this story that we keep telling ourselves that we need something other than what we have in order to be happy. And what I've come to realize is that, you know, I love the phrase, happiness is an inside job, not an outside job. We've been socialized and consumerized into thinking that happiness comes from outside of us, that we need something outside of us to be different before we can be happy. And I've learned that's simply not true. We can set that expectation up, and so we simply put obstacles in our way. But we can be happy right now in this second with exactly what we've got if we decide to be. And so I realize I don't want to spend the rest of my life delaying my happiness, acting as if I need something other than what I have in order to be happy. I made a decision to be happy right here, right now, with exactly what I've got.
And that transition is now into the positive, into where does peace come from? And so you have a list of those as well. So we understand now how we feel. We feed the negative wolf, and now we're the wolf, and now we're looking at the positive stuff. So that's what you understood about, and now, but you actually have a toolbox that will help people find their joy. So let's go into that. And it says there's, people would always, when you tell them that they could be peaceful, there were three common responses.
Right.
So, and I chuckle with that. So go for it.
Well, and I've learned to, I actually, when I begin a presentation, I begin with this often because what I've learned is that there are typically three responses when I present the information that I do. And the first response, and it's usually the majority of people, they will say something like, wow, these are very interesting ideas, and I'm excited to try them and see if they'll make a difference in my life. And I'm always delighted when that's the response. And then there's occasionally a group of people who will say something like, Ted, these are all old ideas. There's nothing new in what you've said. And I say that's absolutely true. I haven't invented anything. I haven't discovered anything. If anything, I've simply recorded or translated or categorized or, you know, simplified what I say is wisdom that's already out there. And I try to language it in a way and in a practice that enables us to live it day by day. But there is nothing new, and so I don't make a claim that I've invented anything. And then the third response, which occasionally shows up and I get a chuckle out of, is that, and this has been said to me, they'll say, Ted, you know, like these are strange ideas, and it seems like you come from a different planet. Maybe you should go back to the planet you came from. And I actually had that happen a few years ago. I was presenting to a group of businessmen in Calgary, Alberta, and at the end of my presentation, I typically go around the room and I invite everybody to say something about what did they hear that was new or different, or what's something that they're going to try in their life as a result of the information they've received. And I got to this one man, and he looked at me, and he just went like, this is nuts, you're nuts, and this is crazy stuff, and like, you know, and he said, you know, you're from a different planet, and you should go back to the planet you came from. And he refused to work with me on the exercise, so I just moved on. But then about 2 years after that, I was invited back to the same organization to present, and I remembered the organization because that kind of comment stayed with me. And lo and behold, before I begin, that very man goes to the front of the room to the microphone, and I'm thinking, uh-oh. And he says in front of all of his peers, he said, he looks at me and he said, this man changed my life. And he said, when I first heard this man speak, I thought he was nuts. But he said, the ideas kind of stuck in me. And he said, I began to think about him. And I realized that he knew something about living life joyfully and peacefully that I didn't. And and I'm grateful for that information. And, you know, it was beautiful to see. And again, you know, I don't take credit for the ideas. The ideas have existed long before me, and I see my job as simply to see if I can share these as broadly as possible. Because I believe that, you know, one of our greatest responsibilities as human beings is to live peacefully and joyfully, and to teach others how to live peacefully and joyfully.
You know what? You know what, Ted, which really cracks me up? He's not the only person who's called you nuts.
That's right.
I'm sorry. I couldn't help resist that one. So,
but you did it in such a loving way, though.
At least I would invite you back. And you wouldn't go, ooh. So you talked, too, about the difference between stress and distress.
Yeah, and so,
so
you
what
know,
is the difference?
This came out of the work of a Canadian researcher on stress, Dr. Hans Selye, actually, and he wrote a body of work, and the title was called Stress Without Distress. And I was confused by it because I used those two words as if they were the same. And here was Dr. Selye saying you could have one without the other. And the short of it is that he says stress is simply a fact of life. It's, you know, we live in a world where there's forces, pressures, you know, there's cold, there's sunlight, there's wind, there's weight, there's all kinds of things. And so, you know, somebody described it as stress is the walk of life. It simply is. It's neither good or bad. It is what it is. And it comes from our external world. And distress is actually our response to stress. It's what we create by our response to stress. And so we can respond to stress with joy, and we can respond to it with distress. And one of the stories that I tell in my work is about my friend Jerome, who had a water skiing accident while he was high on drugs, and he crashed into the shore and became paralyzed from the chest down. And I saw Jerome speak to a group of high school students one day, and in his presentation, he invites the students to ask questions, and one of the students said to him, Jerome, the day you broke your back must have been the worst day of your life. And Jerome said, no, that's not true. It was actually the best day of my life. And Jerome went on to explain how he was living this life of drug addiction and quite a destructive lifestyle. And he said, I wasn't a good human being. I wasn't a good son. I wasn't a good friend. I wasn't any of that because I was into my drugs. And when I broke my back, it caused me really to reevaluate my life. And while he was in hospital recovering from surgeries and learning how to live in a wheelchair, he said, I made a decision that I was going to dedicate my life to working with youth and teaching them about the risks and dangers of drug and alcohol abuse. And he said, that's what I've done. And so I'm living my life on purpose. I'm working with a group of people I really enjoy being with, which is youth, and I'm doing something that I think is important. So he says, that's the day that my life took a right-hand turn and got on track. And what Jerome taught me is it's not about what happens to us. It's our response. It's the story that we tell ourselves about that. It's the meaning that we assign. And I've discovered humans have this incredible ability. We actually think we're the only species on the planet that can do this. We can assign meaning to life. So life shows up, we assign a meaning, or tell ourselves a story, and depending upon the meaning or the story, we have an experience. And that experience can go from despair all the way through joy. And I see that with my son. Is the story I told myself in the beginning was that this condition was unacceptable, and so I was in despair. And since then, I've come to appreciate that my son is an incredibly wise young man who is here to be of service to humanity, and I get to be his dad, and I'm in gratitude. And it's not because his medical condition has changed. It's because I've told myself a different story. I've assigned a different meaning to this journey that I have with him.
I like this part because there's a quote in the book that I think it goes along with, all things are created twice, first in one's mind, then in physical form. Our imagination is very powerful. And then
yeah.
It goes into what we bring intention and attention to.
Yeah. Well, and again, these aren't my ideas, and it was Deepak Chopra that talks about the difference between intention and attention. But I've learned that they're very powerful tools, and it's like we need to consciously recognize that these are tools in our toolbox. And so intention is about what do I intend? What outcome am I looking for? You know, I've learned that, for example, when I do couple counseling, lots of couples will come into my office and they'll spend the whole hour telling me how awful their marriage is. And I used to listen very patiently to their stories, but by the end of the hour, they were in more despair, not less. And so I realized that I needed to work different. And so I started to change the way I worked. And what I would do is when they would start to tell me the negative stories, I would say, well, I'm not really interested in that. And they would kind of look at me like I'm a little nuts. And they would say, well, isn't that why we're here? And I would say, well, that's not how I work. And they would say, well, how do you work? And I'd say, well, listen, the story that I really want to hear from both of you is I'd like each of you to describe for me what a successful relationship looks like from your perspective.
Mm.
And when I ask that, guess what happens? Silence. And then in almost every situation, I kid you not, one will turn to the other and say, you go first. And what I realized is that if I say to them, describe what doesn't work for you, they can talk until they're exhausted. But when I say, describe success for me, they can't do it. And I've learned that until you can describe it, you can't have it. We have this phrase in counseling that says, if you can't name it, you can't claim it. And so what's the intention? What does it look like? When I do my workshops, I often bring some tennis balls with me, and I look for a volunteer, and I say, would you play with me? And they say, sure. And I give them the tennis balls. And then I get a garbage can. I put it about 10 feet away from them. And I say, see if you can get the balls in the garbage can. So, of course, they're usually pretty successful at that. And then I ask if they'd be willing to do it again. And they say yes. I give them back the balls. But this time I take a blindfold out of my pocket and I blindfold them. And then while they're blindfolded, I move the garbage can. And so they throw the balls where they think the garbage can was. And they take off the blindfold and they see all the balls on the ground. And they're a little upset with me. And so I say to them, so what do you think is the moral of this exercise, or what's the point of it? And they usually say something like, well, you can't trust anybody. And I say, no, that's not it. The moral is you can't hit a target you can't see. And so what's our target? What's our intention? And, you know, some of us at the beginning of a year will declare our intentions for the new year. But to me, we ought to be doing that on a regular basis at the beginning of our day. What's my intention for this day? Before a phone call, what's my intention for this call? What would a successful outcome be? And I've just learned that the clearer I am with my intention, the more able I am to actually create it.
Here's one thing, and I think this equates to where you also talk about then getting back to your senses, because when they're... So explain that, because I think that's actually really important, the sense, the ability to be and feel your body and what it's trying to tell you.
Well, that really was a tool that I came to find valuable in my efforts to live in the present moment, to be present right here, right now, because as I said, my mind and my body were usually in two different places. And I went on a weekend retreat. It was a silent retreat. And on the Friday night, the facilitator gave us a list of instructions. And on the list were things like, feel the bark of a tree, feel the dew on the grass in the morning, taste the salt of the ocean, listen to the sound of the wind, and smell the fragrance of the flower. And so I was confused by his instructions, and I said to him, you know, why are you asking us to do these things? And he said, well, let me tell you what I've noticed. I've run this workshop for many years, and what I discovered is most people don't show up. He said, oh, their body shows up, okay, but their mind doesn't show up. It's at home or at work or with a lover or someplace. And unless they bring all of them to this retreat, they don't actually get the greatest benefit from it. And I've learned that if I get them to activate one of their five senses with intention, they move into their body. He said, in order to feel the bark of a tree, you have to be in your body in this second, to smell the fragrance of the flower, to taste the salt of the ocean. And so he would say, activate one of your five senses with intention. And in doing that, you become one. This being of who you are becomes connected. You become one. And I've learned we can do that wherever we are. When we're sitting, you know, we feel our feet on the floor. We feel the seat underneath us. When we're driving in the car and we're starting to get road rage. See, I believe road rage is because I'm here in my car, but I think I should be up there. And we create this mental disconnect. And when we simply bring ourselves back into the car, we feel the steering wheel in our hands, we feel the seat underneath us, we move back into our bodies, the disconnect, the tension releases. And so, yes, that's also an act of intention. Intentionally activating one of your five senses is a beautiful tool to living in the present moment.
Yeah, and no, I think that we just had last show we had Edward Cowie, and he was very much talking about the fusion of sensing and being very present. I know also you're very, very, very passionate about Byron Katie's work. So that also came up in the book. So I love her questions. You know, this is absolutely true.
Yeah. Well.
So yeah.
Byron Katie, it came from she's written a lovely book called Loving What Is, and what she suggests is we don't simply accept what is, we actually love what is. We love what's actually in front of us, no matter how challenging it is. And a beautiful woman, I got to see her in person, and a very powerful way of being. I would say her and Eckhart Tolle are the two people and the Dalai Lama are three people that when I've been in their presence, I feel this beautiful energy of presence. And she has this, she calls it the work, and the work is simply four questions. And so she invites you to identify something that you're challenged with. And it might be, you know, well, my husband doesn't love me, or my wife doesn't love me. And she asks you four questions. The first question is it true? And usually we say, yeah, it's true. She doesn't love me. And then her second question is, are you absolutely certain that's true? And, of course, you have to say, no, I'm not absolutely certain. And then her third question is, well, who are you when you think that way? Who are you when you think your wife doesn't love you? Well, I'm angry and frustrated and hurt and disappointed and scared. And then her fourth question is, who would you be without that thought? Who would you be mm-hmm. without the thought that your wife doesn't love you? Well, I'd be peaceful, joyful, loving, compassionate, open-hearted. And so then she says, is there any good reason to hold on to that thought? Well, there isn't. And then she invites you to do what she calls a turnaround and to take your initial statement, which might be, my wife doesn't love me. And she says, is there another statement, a turnaround statement, that might actually be more true? And often it's the turnaround statement. And a turnaround statement might be, I don't love me.
Right.
Or I don't love my wife. And that's often how we get closer to the truth. So what I like that Byron Katie does is she helps us to what she calls investigate reality. And I think the truth is it's about really investigating the story that we tell ourselves about reality, because we're always telling ourselves a story.
And, yeah, I like this one. Whose business am I in?
Well, that was the other gem that I got from Byron Katie, is she said there's three kinds of business in the world: my business, your business, and God's business. And the first question you should ask if you're in a tough situation is, whose business am I in? And what I realized is that I'd spent most of my life in other people's business, trying to make other people happy, or in God's business. Like with my son's medical condition, I came to the conclusion this is really his business and God's business, whether he recovers from this condition. My business is, how will I respond to this life event that's in front of me? And I spent most of my life not taking care of my business. And I see that for most of us, is that we're meddling in other people's business, but we're not taking care of our business, which is, who am I? What's my way of being? Am I doing a good job of holding my joy, my peace, my compassion, my love, or am I giving it away because somebody doesn't signal in front of me, am I way to work to give away my joy? And I see people so easily give away their joy, and I say, is your joy not worth more than that to you, that you aren't going to hold on to it more intensely, more... take more responsibility for your joy. Don't give it away so easily.
I like this. The other one you have in there is trust, and I like it. Another powerful tool to increase your experience of peace and joy is trust.
Well, I came to realize there's a relationship between fear and trust, and when our trust is low, our fear is high. And as we increase our sense of trust, our fear goes down. And what's amazing is it doesn't matter what you trust. We can trust ourselves. We can trust our mother-in-law. We can trust a higher power. We can trust the generosity of the universe. You know, the act of trust causes us to have no fear. And as part of my journey when I was trying to figure out how to live life peacefully and joyfully, one of the things I did is I read a lot about world religions. And one of the phrases that I found consistent in virtually every major religion is the phrase, fear not. There's no value in fear. And yet most of us, probably if we're honest, we spend a considerable part of our waking moments in a state of fear, in a state of angst. And fear is always about imagining a negative story about the future. It's never about the present moment. We can always manage the present moment. And so I started to deepen my sense of trust, and I wrote statements that I would call my trust statements, and I had them on the wall in my bedroom, and I would read them as I got dressed in the morning. And there were statements like, I trust that whatever happens to me today is for my highest good. I trust that I will do the best I can with what I know. I trust that there's value and purpose in all experiences. I trust that I'm not alone, that I've got resources and caring people and guidance around me that I simply have to be open and receptive to. And what I found was as I would read those statements, I would just have this sense of ease and joy, and I would enter my day fearlessly. And it's a lovely way to begin.
I mean, there's another part, and it says pay attention to your pain so that you don't medicate.
Yeah, you know, what I came to understand is that every human being experiences pain, and we could say, well, that was just a mistake. You know, when the Creator made us as a species, that, you know, somehow there's a mistake in that. Or we could say there's actually some purpose in pain. There's an intention to it. There's a wisdom in it. And see, what I believe, it's our body trying to speak to us to get our attention, saying you're doing something that's not working. You're behaving in a way that's not life-giving or sustainable. You need to change that. And what I noticed in our society is that we have very little tolerance for pain, and so when it shows up, we medicate it. Alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, prescription medication, gambling, TV, video games. And so if we don't hear the message, the body has to speak even louder the next day. So it gets louder and louder and louder. And unfortunately, I think what happens is we get to a state where we have ignored our body for so long that the damage has become significant and we're in trouble. And I believe that if we were much more attentive to our pain, and one of the exercises I regularly do with people when they come in is I say, I'd like you to get a blank piece of paper, and at the top of the page I want you to write this statement. If my pain could speak to me, it would tell me. And I say, just spend some time with that and see what happens. And Karen, I have to say, consistently, people sometimes come in with pages when they stop and just say, what are you trying to tell me? The words come out like, you need to change this. You're working too hard. You're in a job that doesn't bring any joy. You need to be connected to your joy. And so,
that inner wisdom.
Yeah, you know, trusting that there is a divine intelligence in us that if we listen to it in its subtle forms, we can hear it. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for pain medication. I'm not denying that there is. That's compassionate at times. But I also think that we too quickly get in the way of listening to our bodies and saying, what are you trying to tell me?
I love the way you've done breath work. And there's a really great, it's kind of way the book sort of ends, and it's really beautiful. You talk about breath as being a metaphor for life, but how we breathe and how we can actually become centered. So why don't you explain that? It's really a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful description in your book.
Well, again, these aren't my ideas. I simply became aware of them, but I went to a breathing workshop, and the instructor simply explained to us the way our body is physically designed in terms of its breathing mechanism is it's like an old-fashioned bellows, that you open up the bellows, the air comes in, you collapse the bellows, and the air goes out. And the bellows we have is our diaphragm. It's that part of our body below our belly button that should rise and fall with each breath. And if you watch a baby breathe, you see that belly breathing. But most of us, by the time we're five, we stop breathing from our diaphragm, from our belly, and we breathe from our lungs. And we actually don't get enough oxygen. And we become unbalanced when we don't have that breathing from our belly. And he gave us a very simple exercise to do. He said, I want you to sit on the floor, cross your legs, close your eyes, and worry. And he knew that by worrying, our muscles would tighten up and constrict our diaphragm, and we would be in our mental body. And then he came around to each one of us, and he just gave us a little push and was able to knock all of us over onto our backs. And he said, you see how easy it is for me to knock you over? And he said, I can knock you over physically, I can knock you over emotionally, and I can knock you over psychologically. And then he said, let me teach you how to breathe properly. And he talked about the belly needs to rise and fall. And he said, most of you have clothing that's too restricted. Your muscles around your diaphragm are chronically in tension, so I want you to intentionally relax those muscles. And he had us lie on our backs, put our hands on our bellies, and watched until he could see that our hands would rise and fall with each breath. And when all of us were breathing from our bellies, he said, okay, sit on the floor, cross your legs, close your eyes, and breathe from your belly. And then he came around each one of us, and he pushed us again, and he couldn't knock any of us over. And he said, now you're grounded. Now you're centered. You're grounded physically, you're grounded emotionally, and you're grounded psychologically. And he said, you know, those of you that have taken a martial arts course, the traditional teaching in martial arts is to breathe from your diaphragm because your opponent can't knock you over nearly as easily if you simply change your breathing. And he said that's true for our emotional bodies and our mental body. But he did one more thing that I found absolutely fascinating. He had us move the chairs to the edge of the room so there was an open space, and we all stood in the middle, and there was about 15 of us. And he said, I want you to close your eyes, I want you to breathe from your diaphragm, and then with your eyes closed, run around the room as fast as you can in any direction. And you would assume that with 15 people running around with their eyes closed, that it would be chaos. And the amazing thing is that nobody hits anybody. And I could feel people swishing by me, but there are no collisions. And then he says, I want you to stop, I want you to open your eyes, look around where everybody is, and with your eyes open, run around as fast as you can in any direction. And you really can't do it. You know, you take a step, somebody bangs into you, move away from that, you've just banged into the person behind you, move away from them, you bang into somebody else. And so we were quite confused by what we just experienced, and he laughs at us, and he says, in your Western culture, you think your brain is so smart. He said, there's a wisdom in your body far superior to your intellect, and when you close your eyes and breathe from your diaphragm, you access that body wisdom. And I've learned that there is a wisdom inside of us, and we have to move into the stillness. I have that phrase from...
Yeah, go ahead. I was thinking of gut. You know, gut, you know, it's in your gut.
It's in our gut. It's in our being.
Yeah.
And when we connect with our being, we can access that wisdom. I have that phrase from the Bible sitting on my mantelpiece. It says, be still and know that I am God. It's like in the stillness, in the quiet, is where we access a deeper wisdom. You know, when my wife and I go traveling, we typically take one day on our trip where we have it as a day of silence, where we don't use words the entire day. And that's usually our richest day because everything becomes richer and more vibrant, and we learn that we can communicate beautifully without words through look, through touch.
That's nice.
It is.
Yeah. Ted, just because I know we're about getting ready to close, I know you have a new book that you have coming out. Do you want to describe a little bit of it? And maybe we'll have you back on the show when I read that one.
That would be great. So it's called 8 Weeks to a Better Relationship. Sorry?
Okay, go ahead. Go for it. Sorry.
All right. So it's called 8 Weeks to a Better Relationship. And it's simply the ideas. Again, it's a very simple book. It's a very basic book. What I realize is I believe most people in our society don't have the most basic tools in their toolbox, the most basic understanding about how to be in a successful relationship. So in some ways it's very similar to Peace Begins With Me, except it's really about how do we be in a relationship with somebody in a beautiful, rich, intimate way.
Oh, okay. I know I have it, so I'm going to definitely go in and read that one. And I want to thank everybody for being here with us at the Awakening Zone today. If you want to see, Ted has an article in the Subtle Energies issue, which is this month's issue. And next issue is Heaven on Earth. I want to thank the Awakening Zone for allowing Science to Sage to come to fruition. And there's many, many other speakers. They do and pay for the radio show via workshop. So do check out the Awakening Zone. I am very grateful for them. I love them. They're wonderful. And Ted, thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
I love you.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.